This program is a paid commercial announcement and in no way represents the views of WPHT or its management.
Hi, everybody. Welcome to another edition of Recovery Radio. My name is Steve Martorano. We're here talking about the disease of addiction, the substance abuse crisis in this country, and most importantly, the road to recovery. Recovery Radio is sponsored each and every week by Retreat, Premier Addiction Treatment Centers, and we are grateful to once again have two terrific cogs in that organization. The head cog, Peter Schuer, joins us. Peter is CEO and founder of Retreat.
I've never been called the head cog.
Head cog. You are now the head cog.
Is that a compliment?
It is.
Okay.
Well, there's only one head cog. And with him, a major cog in the organization and very frequent guest on the program, Corporate Director of Alumni Services, Maggie Hunt. Hi, Maggie.
Hi, Steve.
All right. You've got your scarf in a position now where you can speak. Scarves, Peter, as you know, get larger by the day.
They get in the way.
Retreat pays the freight here, but those of you who have heard the program understand that what we're not, most particularly, is an infomercial. We are here to tell you about this disease, point you in the right direction if you or someone you know want to get sober, and answer any and all questions. Peter joins us whenever we can corral him because he's a very busy guy and gives us a sort of macro view of where we're at as a society fighting the disease of addiction, and some really new and exciting information about Retreat in general. So welcome, guys, to the program.
Thank you, Steve.
I like to remind people here, Peter, that while the news on a daily basis about substance abuse is almost always grim, you know, there are millions and millions of people who manage to get sober. And I know you reinforce that every time you speak to people, correct?
Correct. That's true.
What are we looking at? Something like 20 million people have managed long-term and successful sobriety in this country right now.
Yeah.
So it can be done. Mm-hmm. But where are we with regard to this battle? I mean,
it's still a lot of work to be done because there's new drugs being introduced to our young people, and it's killing them. The last statistics shown 2017 was 72,000 people died of overdoses. It's the number one killer from 18 to 25 year olds. It's an epidemic, and people are dying.
The numbers, if we didn't know better, you'd think the numbers were an exaggeration, someone trying, but they are stunning numbers. Life expectancy in the richest country on the planet is going in the wrong direction.
First time ever.
Life expectancy, that is a monster notion to get your head around. And the other one that stunned me is that you are now more likely to die from an opioid overdose than in an automobile accident.
Yeah, it's a number one killer for 18 to 26 year olds is overdoses.
So let me ask you, Peter, and certainly chime in, Maggie. I know you will. I mean, is this war or this battle being lost?
It's being fought. I would never say it's being lost because we're still fighting it. We try every day to fight this. We try new different techniques. We try different methods. There's now MAT, medically assisted treatment. There's a lot of different things coming out that we're trying to battle this, but it's a battle. And, we're not ready to throw in the towel. We don't want to see the youth of America die from something that they shouldn't be dying from.
There seems to be two kinds of people who have any opinion at all about substance abuse. There's the general population, which overwhelmingly thinks it'll never happen to me. And then folks that you deal with primarily who have been through this process and are now sober and can't believe everybody else doesn't understand that it's possible. In the middle are people who, not in the middle, but that larger group who are oblivious to this thing. They still haven't gotten the message about how dangerous this moment is.
Yeah, I mean, I can't believe the middle ground is actually not that large either. I think that there's very much people who are in recovery, people who have been affected by addiction, people who are completely ignorant to anything about addiction. And like you said, like, that's never going to happen to me. But I think that there's not a large middle ground of people. I think that there's a lot of the two sides. There's some people who don't know that recovery is possible. And I think that what we're doing is fighting the battle to say that it is possible and that it can, that you can get sober too.
How do we get the message? I mean, efforts like this certainly are important. It's that group that this disease hasn't visited yet that really needs to get the message that it can happen to them.
Yeah, and we do a lot of Q&A events where we invite the public in and discuss the disease of addiction, because, you know, the general public has no idea and no concept that there is a disease. They think it's a character flaw, and that people, you know, they bring it on themselves.
I've said this many times on this program. If addiction were an airborne disease like influenza, and these numbers were resulting in mortality and stuff like that, the entire civilization would be mobilized. The National Guard would be working on this. And it's almost, I mean, it's not too much of an exaggeration, almost suggests that in this environment, it is kind of something you can catch, young people in particular, correct?
Well, it's not a disease that you catch by kissing someone.
But you have a greater likelihood of winding up in trouble.
Peer pressure is really, really tough. And just experimenting, you know, we were all kids once. We experimented with different things, not necessarily with drugs, but things that could be detrimental to our health. But this is killing our kids. And, you know, it just what Maggie said before, there is a group of people who are addicts who can't stop, just shows you how difficult it is and how strong this disease is, that someone knows that what I'm doing is going to kill me, but I can't stop doing it. It's just awful.
We just concluded you guys just concluded a couple of those community outreach Q&As. I was at the one in the Lancaster County area, and you did one in West Palm as well. Maggie, what did you come away with from that experience? I know you sat on the panel.
I was surprised at the amount of questions that people actually do have, partly because I know a lot about addiction and my family knows a lot about addiction. But there was a lot of people who had questions, and there's a lot of people who want to do anything that they can about this like new recovery movement. So I was moved by the questions that people had and the involvement that people want to get into. I think the problem that I saw is that a lot of the conversations that we have are so paramount and they're so important, but it is hard to tell somebody like directly what it is to do. I mean, we can tell them, go talk to the politicians, go talk to these people, but it's hard. People want more of a concrete answer on how we can stop this, and there isn't one yet.
Yeah, Peter, one of the difficulties folks in your business confront is not only the lingering stigma about the disease itself, but some of the myths about treatment. I mean, people still have this notion that, oh, all I got to do is drop my kid off at a facility and I'm done. It's over, right?
30 days, they're healed. Right? Yeah. And then, you know, unfortunately, insurance companies don't give your child 30 days. Now what? You have to have a plan in place. It's a long-term commitment to get yourself clean and sober. It's not something that could be done overnight. And to Maggie's point, what we're saying is people asked a lot of good questions. You know, a lot of parents want to know, how do I know if my child's using? When is it time that I can talk to my child about, you know, can I say, you know, talk to them about the disease of addiction, what could happen? How old should they be? You know, these are the questions that are really good questions that need to be answered, because education is important. You know, people ask all the time, how are we going to battle this? What are we going to do? You have to get out and educate people. You have to educate people on the disease and what could happen, why it happens, what to look for, and this is what's going to help.
Peter Schuer, CEO and founder of Retreat, Premier Addiction Treatment Center, is with us on the program today, along with Maggie Hunt, his corporate director of alumni services. This thing about giving parents the kind of information they need to be proactive about the disease of addiction is kind of interesting, because it's very hard to distinguish between normal antisocial behavior by adolescents, or, you know, growing pains and all that, and red flags. Maggie, you've got young children. I'm certainly not a problem for you yet. But how are you going to deal with it? Because you've been there, done that. How are you going to be able to distinguish between, well, my kid's just being a kid, and maybe my kid's having a problem.
For me, I think that the biggest thing is going to be talking to him about it openly all the time, and not necessarily like scaring him into wanting to stay sober. But I think that just opening the conversation, having him know like some of the risks. I mean, I'm scared because like when you have two parents who are both, you know, who met into the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous, it's a little bit scary when you think about the genetic components that could potentially be within my son and my daughter and my son. But it's scary. I mean, the biggest thing for me is just talking about the conversation. I mean, my son knows that I'm in recovery now. I mean, he knows.
How old is he?
He's seven. He's very intelligent for seven, though, I must say. Pretty much the most. But he's been to AA meetings. Like he grew up in the rooms of AA because a lot of times I'd have to bring him. So I talk to him about it all the time. He knows that like that we don't drink. He knows that like people drink in the world. I mean, he knows that my father died of a drug overdose. Like he is aware of all of these things because I would rather him know about it than not know about it and be afraid to ask me questions.
Peter, how old is your son?
23.
So, and you, I'm sure you've had conversations. When did those conversations with your son start?
I mean, he's grown up in this field.
Right.
I mean, I've been in it his whole life, and I've exposed him to it. He's seen it. My son goes to school in Colorado,
mm-hmm.
and obviously, you know, marijuana being legal. And I told him, I said, just remember what your father does for a living. And what you've seen, because it's very easy to slip over.
Yes.
You know, and he understands that, and he watches it. And look, he's a young kid. He was a very social kid. You know, he did things that, you know, that I didn't approve of, but he's a kid growing up. They've got to make their own mistakes. You know, you try to guide your children the best you can and expose them to things like this also. But you can't lock them in a room and say you can't leave unless you do what I do. But, you know, he exposing your kids and talking about it, like Maggie's saying, is really important. You know, they should know about it. They read about it on the internet. These kids are just so much more advanced than we were.
And they've had friends.
I'm talking about younger kids. I'm talking about kids that are, you know, 8, 9, 10 years
right.
old. They know how to Google something. They see what's going on. It's not like you can't just hide things from them forever. So it is, like we say, it's important. We had someone last night who came in who works for Department of Children's Services and asked a question that was, you know, kind of poignant what we're talking about is where he said, you know, I'm new to this field and I don't know how to tell if someone's using. You know, what do I do? Because, you know, he only sees them for a little while and there's a signs when you're with someone and for, you know, great periods of time, you can see patterns, you can see different things and behavior. But when you see someone just once, you know, it's hard to tell if they're
yes.
using. I mean,
mm-hmm.
it could be tired, it could be whatever. So, you know, that's a good question because his job is to make sure that kids are safe. You know, how
placing them in the right environment.
Parents can say, I don't want to take a drug test, and there's nothing you can do about it. So it's really difficult job they're in to make sure children are safe when they can't tell if someone's using it.
Yeah, I was struck by those questions too at that Q&A. That was you could tell that fellow who asked that question and the gal too. They both needed information to get their jobs right.
Yeah.
Peter Shure and Maggie Hunt from Retreat are with us here on Recovery Radio. We have more with them. Don't go away. Welcome back to Recovery Radio. I'm Steve Martorano. Our guests on the program, Peter Shure, CEO and founder of Retreat, and Corporate Director of Alumni Services, Maggie Hunt. Last segment, guys, we're talking about, you know, how you talk to your children about that, at what point you bring it up. A couple of things come to mind. The DARE program has been in schools for as long as I can remember. That hasn't worked, has it? I mean, not really.
I mean, it's worked somewhat. It's not. And look, you're looking for a great change. That's not going to happen. But if you save one life from something, to me, that works. But again, there's, you know, they need to update it and get more involved in what's going on in the world today.
I mean, go ahead, Mike.
Oh, I was just going to say, well, we did the DARE program when I was in school, and what I remember from the DARE program is, like, packets. We had packets, and it would be like showing it was showing kids like this is, you know, this is what drugs are, this is what, but it wasn't anything about like why you shouldn't do them. It really was like introducing drugs overall. And then I remember, I mean, my DARE officer was there like when I got in trouble in Bucks County. So it's like, you know, there's not a lot of follow through. You have DARE for like a week and then it's over.
Yeah, I've heard that from educators too who've seen the DARE program and they just walk away going, I don't know. It looks like they're telling them stuff that they might not even be aware of. So now we are swept up in this legalization of marijuana movement. I mean, it's easy to see where this is heading. I don't know how many states now. I think it's 8 or 9 that have legalized recreational marijuana. I'll ask the question. I think I know the answer. Is this a good idea, Peter?
As studies show, and this is from Colorado, that driving under the influence has gone up about 300% since it started. Besides that, you know, people ask us all the time, is marijuana a gateway drug? Meaning that, is it going to lead to something else? And I can honestly say in my whole life, I don't know anyone who's tried marijuana that hasn't at least tried something else. Doesn't mean they're going to become an addict. That's not what we're saying. But they're going to try it. And when they try it, they might like it. And that could lead to addiction. So I don't see any benefit from it other than making dollars for a state. I can understand that part of it. But again, I think it's detrimental to legalize another substance that's mind-altering. Should they decriminalize it? Yeah, I don't want to see kids who carry a joint around get a criminal record because I think that's silly. But, you know, to publicize it and exploit that now it's legal and now you can smoke it, you're all right to do that if you're 21 years old, I don't see a benefit in it. That's my opinion, but, you know, I'm one of millions that are against it, but there's millions that are for it.
Yeah, this is a social experiment that I don't think we've taken enough time to, you know, wonder about unintended consequences. For instance, one of the unintended consequences here of this move towards legalization of marijuana, it's made your job as a mom harder, right? Mm-hmm. Trying to tell kids about the dangers of drugs.
Yeah. I think that marijuana 100% is a gateway drug, and mainly because if you are smoking marijuana or buying marijuana or hanging out with people who are doing marijuana, like exactly like Peter said, they definitely have other substances or know where you can get other substances. And that's kind of like where it leads. And eventually people talk about the different highs that the different drugs give you. And curiosity's killed the cat, or is that how, you know, that's what happens. I'm serious. Cause that's what it was for me. And that's
nine times it killed the cat.
Yeah. Well, I did go to treatment 10. So
that's why
counts.
Cats are so curious. They know they got 9 chances. Well, that's an interesting take on the notion of a gateway drug, which, you know, after doing this show and hearing you guys for so many years, I kind of changed my mind about that. I mean, yes, you're right. It puts you in an environment that almost automatically may lead to something else, just in terms of youthful experimentation. But I mean, addiction is not based on some pathway, some beginning point. I mean, it's always the same. If you're going to get hit by this disease, if you are going to become a substance abuser, it doesn't make any difference where you start, does it?
No, absolutely not.
It can start with cigarettes. It can start with coffee. Yeah. It can start with anything. I mean, this is an organic problem that you don't.
The difference is with substance, though, especially with opiates, it's a physical addiction, where it's a little different than drinking coffee and getting addicted to that.
Because of tolerance levels and stuff?
Well, it changed your brain chemistry. It's a little different, opiates, what it does, and your opiate receptor, your dopamine receptors are depleted because of the opiates, and it's much more complicated when drug addicts are using opiates than anything else. Because when we say, look, there's 30 million people in the United, more than 30 million people have some kind of addiction. Doesn't necessarily mean substance abuse, addiction, but a good majority of that are addicted to substance, and that's what's killing our country.
That brain chemistry description needs to be better understood by the public because this came up at the Q&A the other evening. When you see people behaving in self-destructive ways, doing things that even they know are ruining their lives and killing their families, and but they continue doing it. You can go, well, gee, that's a bad person, or there's something wrong with that person. Yeah. They're not thinking properly.
No, that's a sick person. That's someone who needs help. That's someone whose brain chemistry is telling them, this is what I need. You know, how are you responsible for that? How do you say to someone, just don't do that?
Right.
But my brain is telling me I need to do that. That's why they need to learn some structure and how to beat that. And it's not so easy. They need to have sometimes they need some medically assisted treatment to get them to that point.
Maggie, you're in recovery now almost a decade, right?
Almost, yeah.
Almost a decade. And I know I've heard you talk about this. You look back at your behavior and you're just astonished the things that you were willing to do just to get high, right?
Well, what I think what happens is when you're coming down from the substance, all the serotonin in your brain is depleted. So there's no happiness and your brain is literally telling you, if you don't get this substance, you're going to die. So it's like survival mode. It's flight or flight or fight or flight response. Like that's what happens. So I'm not thinking, oh, I really don't want to like steal this from my mom because like I know she worked hard for it. I'm thinking like I'm not going to live. I'm just gonna, well, in my mind, I would think I was just going to like combust if I don't.
Maggie's not dramatic though.
If I don't get the money to get this substance, that's what's going to happen. But it was a lot of the brain chemistry telling me to do that because as a sober, sane person, like I don't want to do any of those things.
Maggie Hunt, Corporate Director of Alumni Services, along with Peter Shore, who is the founder and CEO of Retreat. This is Recovery Radio. Don't go away. Welcome back to Recovery Radio. We'll return with Peter and Maggie straight ahead. But this is the portion of the program where I give you a phone number for a Retreat, and I tell you every week, I hope you never, ever have to use it. And I know that Peter and everybody in Retreat hopes you never have to use this. But this disease arrives unannounced. No one's ever ready for it. No one ever plans ahead. And they have to make extraordinarily difficult decisions under enormous pressure and often don't know what to do. I mean, you guess you can Google stuff, but it won't give you the kind of answers you're going to need. So that's why Peter said, give them our phone number and make sure they understand that we're there as a resource. We'll help them in any way we can. Their reputation is well established. They've helped lots and lots of people at Retreat, but we're not here to tell you it's the only way you can get sober. Here's their phone number. You know you have those fire and emergency numbers on the magnets on your refrigerator, poison control. They're up there in an emergency. This number should be in a drawer someplace. 855-859-8808. That's how you reach Retreat Premier Addiction Treatment Centers. Here's what I guarantee you. When you call that, someone, an actual person, will answer the phone and just tell them what your question is. You'll get some maybe life-saving information from them. 855-859-8808, Retreat Premier Addiction Treatment Centers. Their CEO and founder, Peter Shore, is our guest, along with his Corporate Director of Alumni Services, Maggie Hunt. You just heard me do the Retreat Premier Addiction Treatment tagline.
Yeah.
There's some exciting news about changes.
Yeah, you're not going to be saying that much longer.
I know that. Tell us what's afoot for you guys.
Well, Retreat has always treated people holistically, the whole person. And what we've seen over the years, probably north of 80% of the population that comes in has some mental disorder that goes untreated. And if that goes untreated, nothing changes. You know, it's just a vicious cycle that keeps going and going and going. Not necessarily everybody's going to need that, but a great majority of the people today have some kind of mental disorder that we need to treat. So we made a conscious decision. I mean, years ago, we've always treated this on a peripheral way. But now we received our mental health license in Pennsylvania. And we're rebranding ourselves to have the name Retreat Behavioral Health because we are a complete behavioral health company now, where we treat not only addiction piece, but the mental health piece.
You guys were at the forefront, as you say, even before this change of branding. The condition that you're referring to is called co-occurring.
Well, even more than co-occurring disorders. I mean, it really is a mental health facility. It's not an acute psychiatric hospital. That's not what it is. It's mental health facility where we've always had, you know, when a patient was, you know, showed signs of schizophrenia or something like that, and they weren't able to regulate their medication, we'd have to send them to the word higher level of care. Well, now we are the higher level of care. We don't have to do that. And we can manage the patient. We can, you know, get them stabilized so they can stay in treatment and take care of both the mental health problem and the addiction piece.
In your experience, Maggie, how common is it for people to have a behavioral or a mental health component part of their substance abuse?
Oh, yeah. I mean, it happens all the time. And actually, specifically, especially for females, a lot of their co-occurring disorders come out once they put the substance down. So for a lot of females who struggle with like suicidal ideation or eating disorders, they'll put the substance down and they'll pick right up on you know, purging or binging or not eating anything at all. So we see it all. I see it all of the time. When I was working, I worked second shifts and facilitated groups all the time, and it affects, I would say, more than half of our population.
Peter, you'll be prepared then to handle all kinds of situations,
trauma, PTSD, yeah, all kinds of situations like that. And it's you know, it's could probably be, you know, you don't get a lot of time for mental health patients. So a diagnosis of mental health, you won't get the same length of time you will for an addiction. But the outpatient part of it, where you get individual counseling, all these different services, that psychiatric services and medication management and things like that, what's really going to keep the person in a straight path. So the addiction piece becomes secondary after that. Once you start dealing with the mental health issues and they put the substance down, now the work starts.
So how will that work practically from you know, a ground level at retreat? If I come here and I want to be treated for substance abuse and I'm not particularly concerned about my emotional state, will I be directed to a certain group of people, certain techniques?
Yeah, I mean, it will mostly happen. But we do it now. We identify people with you know, different issues, especially young women with trauma and things like that. We identify that now, and we have specialty groups for them. But the aftercare part of it is where it becomes difficult, because there aren't any many mental health facilities that for a step down of PHP and IOP.
And so there's no like sober living,
right,
facility.
So you're sending them to a drug and alcohol PHP IOP. They're not getting the help they need. They really need to get something on the mental health side of it.
You know, when people have said to me, well, how do you even know what kind of a facility you need to go to? What should you be looking for? I always tell them, you'll know a lot about the place you're going to by the first people you start to talk to. That process, I guess you guys call it intake. What you know, when you evaluate people, because they don't know what they need. I mean, they know they have a problem,
yeah,
but they don't know what they need. Can you explain a little bit about what that how that happens here?
Most people coming in are pretty toxic. So they don't know. It's hard to do an assessment when someone's toxic.
Right.
So you have to really wait till they've come down a little. And even that, you know, a lot of people come in and they say, I'm bipolar. I was diagnosed as bipolar. They diagnose someone with bipolar disorder when they're in their throngs of addiction. It's just a waste of time and a waste of energy to say that, because it's how do you know it's not the drugs causing the up and down mood swings? So we have to detox them for whatever substance they have and do a real proper assessment. I mean, we do an assessment when they first come in, a psychosocial, get all their information, talk to family members, find out any information they might have on that. It's a whole process. We want to get as much statistics as we can on someone to really help them to see what's the best fit for them. What do they need? What's their needs?
Mm-hmm. What can people expect in terms of the timeline here from the moment they show up at, for instance, retreat to getting into the, you know, getting a bed or something? How long is that process?
Well, I just wanted to answer your question before that, because you said about the intake, and for people, I mean, for family members, if they're calling and they want to find like that perfect facility for their child or their loved one, that intake, that first person that they talk to, that does have a big impact on them. I know, like for my mom, when she was looking at a facility, the first person who she talked to, that gave her a listening ear and told her about the program that they offered, that was where she wanted to send me at that time. And so luckily for us, we have a call center where people can call. We can give them all of the information, and we can do that as well. But to your other question, what was the other question that you asked me before?
What's the time? Is there a typical timeline? Somebody shows up here in crisis.
Oh.
How the process works is that there's a phone call made.
Right.
And they'll call our admissions department. Admissions department will do a short assessment, take all their information on substance and this and that. They'll verify their insurance benefit that they have for this level of service that they want to come in. And then, depending on where the patient is, you know, it could be a matter of minutes to hours, we'll send transportation to go pick up that patient. Then they get picked up, they come, and they see an intake counselor immediately. Mm-hmm. And I mean, as soon as they get there, and they assess the situation, they talk to them, they see, they get all the information, we have nursing come down, take vital signs, make sure they're stable. Get all that information, call into the insurance company. You can't call into the insurance company until the patient's in front of you. And get all that information, set that up. Within an hour, they're admitted and in a bed already.
What kind of advice can you give family members who have made that call, think this is the facility that they want to get their loved one to, and then the loved one starts to resist it or is foot dragging? Is there any advice you can give people in situations like that? I know when your drivers are guests on the show, they are such an critical link. They're the last mile to get somebody here. So they've heard all the excuses and pull over, let's have one drink before we go, all that stuff. What about family members? Is there any advice you can give, Mag, to somebody who goes, okay, I got the place, let's go, and then they start, you know, dragging their feet?
Well, I would probably tell family members to take it a step ahead of time, have everything set up and ready to go if somebody is resistant before. Usually you know if somebody's going to, like, if they're going to go in willingly or if there's going to be a little bit of resistance. But it's hard. I mean, that's the biggest thing that family members struggle with, having support around you when you're ready to make the decision to go. It's hard. In Pennsylvania, there's no laws that can mandate somebody to drug and alcohol inpatient treatment. So it's one of the biggest hurdles that parents and family members deal with all the time.
There are no bars at a facility like Retreat.
No.
There are circumstances I can certainly see where someone ought to be committed to a facility because they're a danger to themselves or others.
Yeah, that's what you call in Pennsylvania is Act 302, mm-hmm. where you throw someone to a mental health facility and they're there for at least 72 hours for evaluation and maybe longer depending on what the evaluation would say. And I always tell people, I'm going to 604 you. And they say, what's that? I go, well, you're acting so crazy that I'm going to do it twice.
I need you twice.
Yeah.
But generally speaking, it's kind of oxymoronic to expect that you can force somebody against their will to come to a treatment facility.
It's even worse than that. You know, when an 18-year-old kid comes in and parents bring him in, and the parents are so involved and entrenched in this, they want their kids to do really well, and the kid says, well, I don't want my parents to know anything that's going on here. They're an adult. You know, HIPAA laws say we can't tell anybody anything because they said that. Terrible. I mean, parents, they don't understand that. They just, what do you mean? I'm paying for this. I want to know what's going on. I said, and, you know, we wish we can tell you, but they said that they don't want you to know anything. We have to respect them as an adult, even though they act like a child and they're your child, that we can't release any information on that patient. It's really heartening to see a family member hear that because they want to know that their kid's doing well.
And we're going to take a break here now, but before we do, this one last notion with regard to that initial period of time. How soon does the family find out what their role in the treatment's going to be? Because a lot of people, as I say, think they can drop this problem off, go away, and someone will call us when it's better. Do you tell them almost immediately, look, we have families involved in this and
we
support
do. We do family workshops. The therapist will do a family session with the it depends. Again, you know, we have to take everyone's an individual. You know, the families could be the part of the problem too. You know, we have to kind of sort it out before we make any decisions on what kind of family participation that's going to be part of this process.
Peter Shore and Maggie Hunt from Retreat Behavioral Health.
Soon.
And more of Recovery Radio straight ahead. Please don't go away. Welcome back to Recovery Radio. Again, we're here for the purpose of talking about the disease of addiction. It is much in the news. We are in a tremendous crisis with opioids, among many other substances being abused. And this program is dedicated to sounding the alarm. I mean, there's no other way to put it. Letting people know that we are all in risk as this disease rages through the country. Recovery Radio is sponsored by Retreat. Premier Addiction Treatment Centers for the time being. Their founder and CEO, Peter Shore, and his corporate director of alumni services have been our guests, Maggie Hunt. I want to end on this last piece because this last segment, because it's the hardest question for me when I have people who come up and go, you know, they asked a couple of things. Relapse is one big one for them. They can't get their head around that. Oh, it doesn't work. They always relapse. But the larger one is, how do I identify the problem before it happens? What advice are we giving them in that regard, Mac?
That's why we want family members who don't have kids in addiction now to be part of this. We We want people, we want to advocate for the people who are not addicts yet. And they don't, and they're not part of that because we need to educate them. You know, we tell parents all the time is, you know, if you see mood changes of your child, if you see physical appearance changing, including hygiene, if you see them with, you know, new friends that are kind of, you know, a little shady, if you see them, you know, isolating themselves all the time and not talking to you and being part of the family anymore. There's a lot of different signs you see, you know, of kids that are you know, change. Not look, kids have growing pains. They change all the time. But you can see certain things that are so out of the norm for your child, something's up. And you need to address that quickly before it escalates and gets to be, you know, a real serious problem.
You know, Maggie, as a mom, you're going to be confronting this, already have. In the past, it was easy for parents to go, oh, they're being kids. They're driving me nuts and they're pains in the neck, but they're just being kids and they're growing pains. We parents don't have that luxury anymore, right?
Yeah, I mean, it's not the what's killing kids nowadays too is a one-time use. Like, not that everybody used to survive, you know, from using heroin, but like when I first got sober 10 years ago, I didn't hear about half of the people who were dying that there is now. So I think that talking to them about even a one-time use could potentially like be a fatal dose for you. Like, I think it'll help talking about it though, because talking about it is really going to be the best thing that works.
And talking about it in the right, Peter, I hear what you say. All those things are, you know, should be red flags for you. Change in friends is particularly easy to see as a parent. Mm-hmm. I don't like his new friend. Why do you get new friends, right? The grades drop off, sullenness, and all that stuff. We just don't have any margin of error anymore. You can't just write it off. No. You've got to be worried about that. And do something about it.
Just to go back what you said before about gateway drugs and trying something new. And Maggie's right. You know, someone could try heroin one time and that could be
and be dead.
Because it's not heroin. You don't know what you're getting. You're shooting fentanyl in your arm. Or carfentanyl in your arm. You're dead before the needle's out. And that's one time.
You know who could really lead this charge to educating people who you know, don't think it's going to happen to them. I think that that's young people can be leaders in that, because if we can get to the point where it's cool if somebody says I don't smoke marijuana, like it's okay. Wasn't okay when I was a kid. Somebody said they didn't smoke marijuana. You sort of went, well, something wrong with them. I mean, what do you mean? Or I don't want a beer. Are we getting close? I think kids are getting a lot smarter about this. I hope they are.
I mean, I think that the world is kind of going towards like the peer recovery specialists, just like people who are positively influencing. Because I think that the more that we can change that perspective and being in recovery is actually really cool, the better off we're going to be.
Do you have is there a possibility or a program here at Retreat where you could bring in you know, sober kids, kids who don't have the problem, and let them
scared straight.
Well, not scared straight. Let them talk to some of the kids, the young people that are up here.
I'll tell you the problem. Like I explained before, is privacy and HIPAA compliance and doing that. But alumni can do
that.
That's
what I was just going
to
say. Yep.
You know, alumni. You know, what Maggie heads is that's great to do that, and that's why we want to be involved with schools, because that's where it's at. You know, and you don't have to be in high school. You know, from junior high school, middle schools, that's where it's starting. You know, they need to have people. And I'm sure we'd be more than happy to get alumni to come and talk about, you know, look, a lot of people who are in addiction are not public speakers, and it's hard to kind of, you know, get people to buy into what you're saying because they're telling their story. And some of these stories are really scary, you know. I mean, for other people hearing that, you know, you don't like, wow. But, you know, other kids, if you don't engage and you're not an engaging speaker, kids don't pay attention to you. So we have some speakers that are amazing. And, you know, one of our senior clinical supervisors, Jarrell, goes to different schools, and he was a college athlete, and they relate to him. And, you know, that's what you need to do. You need to find someone who's going to be, you know, engaging, and people are going to relate to what they have to say. Because that goes far. That goes far. Yeah. Just someone coming in to speak and they don't have any kind of engagement with the people they're talking to, nothing's really going to happen.
Yeah, you just got to find that one person who you think is really influential and really cool, and then sobriety might look good to you.
Well, no, cool is the right word. When you can convince young people that sobriety is cool and sexy, and attractive.
Parents can't do that.
No, they cannot do it. Mm-hmm. They cannot do it. In fact, there's almost a counter reaction to that. If they're telling you not to do it, it's probably something I should be doing. Mm-hmm. But somebody, you know, the first time a girl thinks a guy is cuter because he doesn't get high, we're a long way down the road of getting a handle on this. Yeah. And Peter Shore, CEO, founder of Retreat, we thank you for the work you do. I thank you for supporting the show. Always appreciate
that. Thank you for what you do.
And Maggie Hunt, Director of Corporate Alumni Services. Always a pleasure to talk to you. Guys, that's it for this edition, and thanks for listening. Don't forget, we are available wherever finer podcasts can be heard, and that's almost everywhere. This is Recovery Radio. We'll catch you next time around. Bye-bye.
This program is a paid commercial announcement and in no way represents the views of WPHT or its management.